This episode is brought to you by our friends at Bimuno. Feeling out of balance could be linked to your gut health. Bimuno is the daily fiber supplement that increases the levels of good gut bacteria and helps people to enjoy the benefits of a balanced gut within just 7 days. It's simple to take and fits easily into your daily routine. Hello and welcome back to Wellness with Lizelle. And this week I am so delighted to be joined by Professor of Genetics, best-selling author and leading gut guru, none other than Tim Spector. Now, in his book, The Diet Myth, Tim shared that the key to health and weight loss lies not in the latest fad diet, nor even in the simple mantra of eat less, move more, but in the microbes already inside us. And only by understanding what makes our own personal microbes tick, he says, can we overcome the confusion of modern nutrition and achieve a healthy gut and a healthy body. He is, ladies and gentlemen, right here, right now to talk more on this. Welcome, Tim.
Hello there.
It's great to see you. I've heard you speak many times and we are really so thrilled that you are coming to do this literal deep dive into our insides. Because what's fascinating about you and the fact that you are now known as the leading gut guru is that you didn't start off in kind of gastroenterology, did you? You started off on a completely different medical field, the genetics.
Well, even before genetics, I was actually a rheumatologist. So
really?
Dealing with bones and joints. And still do an occasional clinic in that that sphere just to keep my hand in. But so I've always wanted to go for the what I found those most exciting areas. And obviously, as a doctor, you have to have a speciality, so you pick them slightly arbitrarily. And I had a very good time as a rheumatologist, and a lot of rheumatology is talking to patients and psychology and that sort of holistic. Mm. Approach, but I was always more interested in the research than just the clinical practice. And so when the research opportunities sort of started drying up in that field, I was always looking for something else. And then the twin study came along.
Mm. And that's at King's, is that because that's where you're based now, is it?
Yes. I mean, for a few months, we were actually at a small hospital called Barts Hospital in London. And then I got a job at St. Thomas's Hospital.
And you still have the best office in the whole of London, because I have been there.
Yes.
You have the corner office on, what is it, like the fourth or fifth floor of St. Thomas's, overlooking the Houses of Parliament, right on the river.
Yes.
Doesn't get any better, does it, really?
No, the MPs get a crummy view and we get a very nice
view.
They
look at you and you
exactly. And it's one reason I've never moved, is when you have a dream location like that every day. So I've been very lucky. And because I set up the twin study, which is these 14,000 twins that we've been following for 25 years, I've been able to actually follow what I think are the most exciting bits of science and sort of modify what I was interested in every 5 years or so, still using exactly the same design of these amazing volunteer twins from all over the country.
So your twin study was set up 25 years ago. That's when you started it.
That's when I started
Man
it,
Man and boy, you've been looking at twins and genetics.
Yes, I sort of joke I've only ever had one good idea in my life and that was it. But if you're gonna have one, make sure it's
a real cracker.
Yeah.
And of course, looking at genetics feeding into microbiome, at what point did you realize that, hold on a minute, the twins are genetically identical? Because presumably they are identical twins.
Half and half.
Are they half and half? Okay. So with the ones who are genetically identical, you started to see interesting traits within their gut. How did the whole gut thing happen?
Well, obviously the first, I guess, 10 years of doing the twin studies is all about, wow, that's amazingly genetic. Things like back pain and arthritis and asthma and osteoporosis and the menopause and things that you didn't think were genetic turned out to be genetic. Then really from the last sort of 10 years, it's been looking at why identical twins end up being quite different. They don't die of the same diseases. They generally don't get the same cancers. They live different times. And so you're starting to explain this rather strange quirkiness of why two identical clones would quite be so different. And for a while I looked and saw if their genes are obviously identical, but their there was something called epigenetics, these little chemicals that switch genes on and off. And I looked at that for a few years. But that wasn't a big explanation. But what turned out for me, the big explanation was the discovery really of this community of microbes in our gut, the gut microbiome, and the fact that twins really didn't share many of those microbes with each other. So the one big thing was different about identical twins were their gut microbes. And that led me really down this route to say, if that makes twins different, what about all of us? And how, you know, they could be so crucial to so many diseases and health and our reaction to food.
Because when identical twins are born, am I right in saying, or when any of us are born, actually, we have no gut microbes as such at all for that instant when we pop into the world?
That's right. So for practical purposes, we're born sterile, and the birthing process is a very careful evolutionary tool that every mammal has that ensures that it's a very messy, mucky process,
right,
where we rub our faces against our mother's bottoms. And
we're
magically
meant to do that.
we're designed to do that. It's
amazing.
Meant to be exactly that. And that seeds, those microbes come from our mothers and the birth canal and a bit, you know, from all those orifices.
Yeah.
And get into the baby's gut. And that allows then a colony to start multiplying and you'll be able to digest the breast milk.
Right.
So it's really crucial to be able to digest breast milk properly in those first few days.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a lot of other bits of it from the breast milk.
Because there's colostrum to start with, isn't there? Which presumably has that got lots of great bugs in it?
They used to think it was sterile, but we now know that all colostrum and breast milk now has key microbes in it. We've got no clue how they get there.
Right.
You don't really understand it. It's kind of weird
that
women are growing these particular microbes in their breast milk in order to feed the kid. And then, of course, the skin of the mother also is another source of microbes. And so it's this whole environment that's all there in order to get the microbe kick-started.
Right.
So that the infant has a functioning immune system, most importantly,
mm-hmm.
and also is able to digest food and grow.
Right.
And that you can think about how important that is to evolution. Everyone's got to have that. That's why it's so well developed. That's why it's such a key part of us.
Mm.
And this process makes sure that the first 3 years of life, you know, is their kids are totally protected. And that's why we think that cesarean section births, for example.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Supposing that happens.
It all goes a bit wrong.
Does it really? And is that borne out with statistics?
Yeah, so the epidemiology studies now show multiple times that on average, not every kid at all, ends up being slightly fatter and slightly more allergic than kids born
really?
Naturally. And that includes me. So
you are not in the slightest bit fat.
But just think how skinny I could be if I was born normally. And of course, my microbes when I was born didn't resemble my mother's at all. I was a very premature birth. They probably resembled.
Right, so you were whipped straight into an incubator, were you?
Yes, and I was bright yellow and hairy. And
wow.
My microbes probably came from, you know, the random nurse that picked me up.
Gosh.
Or the microbes from the plastic and incubator.
So are people aware of that now? If you have a cesarean section, do the babies get swabbed with the mother's like vaginal fluids, or is there a process in place now to make that happen?
No, it's there are some Scandinavian hospitals where they do that routinely,
mm-hmm.
but in this country and in the US, it's frowned upon.
No way. Should we be asking for it as women if there are, you know, pregnant mums listening or grandmums? Is that something that we should be pushing for, do you think?
I think you should have that discussion with your doctors, but there's always a group of doctors that worry about doing some harm. So there are
Come on, that's what you're supposed to be doing, surely.
It's exactly
that's the way
natural,
you're
but
meant to
there
deliver
was
a baby.
There were a group of microbiologists who wrote in the BMJ a couple of years ago that this was terribly dangerous because you could be passing on infection from the mother to the baby, although that's what normally happens. They were worried about streptococcus and other things like this. So there's a lot of resistance in the medical world to doing things that are more natural,
mm-hmm.
particularly if you're sort of having someone intervene because it's not you know, someone's got to actually do the swabbing and take responsibility for it, and you end up with this whole thing. So, but the jury is still out about how useful it is, or whether it, the swabbing, yes, the official work, yeah, actually works. Although a lot of my colleagues in the field, you know, themselves would practice it.
Right.
But it, the studies are not yet convincing, mm-hmm, that that's what you want to do. And there are some mothers you wouldn't necessarily want their microbes, you know.
Right, so, okay,
you know, if you're very sick or you've got other problems, you, okay, may actually be quite happy with the nurse's skin microbes.
Right.
And, of course, yeah, breastfeeding also makes up for it as well. So,
right,
the real problem is mothers who don't breastfeed and have a cesarean section. That's a sort of double whammy, and that's, people are starting to think about probiotics and other things,
fascinating,
for those kind of conditions. So, but it's, you know, we didn't know any of this sort of 5 years ago.
It must be really exciting to be at such the forefront of so many things, because I think what triggered my interest in gut health is that every medic I spoke to from every area of medicine, whether we were talking to, you know, cancer, you know, oncologists, or people, you know, looking at rheumatoid arthritis or Parkinson's or brain activity, mental health specialists, dermatologists looking at skin, you know, everything seems to lead back to the gut somehow.
It is, and it is super exciting, because it's like we've discovered a totally new organ in our bodies. Imagine, you know, you didn't know the liver existed, and you suddenly said, gosh, it does all these interesting things, and detoxifying this, and, you know, it's quite hard to live without a liver. So basically, that's really what we're understanding now. It's a bit like going back to the Middle Ages and, you know, suddenly making it about how blood goes around the body, you know, mm-hmm, Harvey's discovery. So, and it makes you look at everything in a different way, and it starts, lots of things start to fall into place. This whole idea of gut feelings and
yes,
the emotions, you know, and how your gut tenses up when you're stressed, or your toilet habit does reflect your mental state.
Yeah.
Suddenly, all these things start to make a lot of sense once you realise that we have to start to deal with the whole new organ there, and that this is a chemical factory we're dealing with. People just think of them as bugs. We're talking about 100 trillion microbes here, mainly bacteria, but also viruses and fungi and little parasites. But all together, what they're doing is they're producing thousands of chemicals every minute of the day that are interacting with our body, that get send signals to our brain, that keep our immune system intact, that feed the cells lining our guts, that have effects not only breaking down all our foods, but also how we interact with all our medicines. Mm. They think currently that about 3/4 of all the medicines we take are interacting with our particular gut microbes, which determine how well they work or how quickly they're cleared from the system. And once you realise that, and you realise that actually everybody has a unique set of microbes,
yeah,
it explains so much, you know, all these things, you know, why does alcohol have a different effect on me than someone,
sure,
else? Why does paracetamol work for some people and not others?
Yeah, and not others.
Why do antidepressants work in some and not others?
Yeah.
And you just suddenly think, wow, you know, and why do some diets work in some people and not others? So it suddenly all falls into place when you realise that we have this amazing individuality. We now, you know, are able to understand it. We can measure it. And you know, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We're seeing what it all, how clever this system is.
Yeah, because your book was the diet myth. So was that really based on that, the fact that there is no one size fits all for eating, and that we need to listen or be aware of what our microbes are doing in order for us to be able to lose weight effectively?
More or less. I mean, it was a very, the title was a general one, really to say that most of what we know about nutrition is misinformed. Not all of it, but certainly a large part of that nutritional advice, which is based on a very sort of mechanistic calories in, calories out, a sort of furnace type, you know, physicists have sort of worked out that we're just this giant tube that stuff goes in and out, and we just got to measure it properly.
Yeah.
Count the calories in one end, and you just have your ACTI watch the other end, and you'll be perfect. And in the book, I go through why all the evidence is showing that's rubbish.
But that's not a pink ticket to go and eat lots of cream buns, presumably.
Absolutely
or can
not.
Some people do that? Are those annoying people that could just live
there
on
are.
Carbs?
There are, and we come across them all the time. But they're certainly the minority of our population, right. And you're taking a big risk if you just gamble on you being that person. But, you know, most of us, when you were young, you know, felt we were that person.
Yeah.
But what this is really showing is that it's changing the paradigm, and it's explaining a lot of these reasons that some people do better on some diets than others. Mm. This idea that, you know, all women have 2,000 calories as their optimal level, and if they go just below that for long term, they'll lose weight, is proven to be nonsense, really. That,
yes.
You know, that might be in some experimental situations an average.
Right.
But no one's actually considered the individual differences between people, or the fact that, you know, on identical calorie diets, people on high fat or high carb will have very different responses.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the way we react to foods, we're understanding, is far more complex than just burning it in these calorimeters, as the books tell us. And, you know, our response to exercise is different, our response to temperature is different, all kinds of extra complexities have come into this equation. And the nutrition science hasn't really kept up. It means the guidelines haven't kept up. And this is really what I was exposing in that book, is that, you know, exposing A, the things that we don't know and the things we've got wrong, and that in general, a lot of these things can be explained by our individual gut microbiomes. And if we can understand that, we know how to treat them well, these gut microbes, we can really start to improve our health in ways that, you know, are a long-term benefit rather than just the short-term quick fix of the super, you know, starvation diet or the...
So it's kind of look after your microbes and your microbiome, and your microbes will look after you. Is that the kind of the bottom line?
That's... Couldn't say it better, yes, that's it.
Excellent. Now tell me about the twin study, because I know that the most recent research is showing that the differences between these genetically identical pairs of identical twins is even more startling than perhaps you might have first thought.
Yes, so we've just finished analysing the first results of this study, which is the largest nutrition study of its kind ever done.
Wow.
So we're talking things on a massive scale. So we had 1,000 UK participants, mainly twins, and we also had 100 volunteers from Boston, and they were at the Mass General, well-known hospital at Harvard, and the others here were at St. Thomas's Hospital. And everybody came in for a day, and they had an intensive clinic visit where blood was taken 10 times during the day, and they were all given a high-fat, high-carb breakfast and then a normal carb and fat lunch at exactly the same time in precise conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And we measure their responses in terms of the insulin, the glucose and the fats and a whole level of other chemicals. And then they went home for 2 weeks, given a glucose monitor to put on, these new technology machines that record every minute of the day for 2 weeks.
Amazing.
And you can get your result on your phone. And they were also instructed how to jab their fingers so we can tell what their fats were doing after fatty meals.
Fingerprint blood test.
Yes.
Instant.
Mm. And they also had wearables to look at the effect of exercise and sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And they were logging all their foods with this app that we've been developing with this company called Zoe.
Right.
And this allowed them to take pictures of their foods and relay them. We were talking to a nutritionist in real time. So it was the most well-performed and most compliant study I've ever seen, because 95% of people actually did this for the two-week period.
Which, how
if anyone's done a diet study, they'll know how difficult that is.
Yeah.
And what we showed was, firstly, the enormous variation between individuals. Yes, we saw the average, which is what is reported in the medical press about how quickly your sugars go up after a standard amount of carbohydrate and your fats, etc., which normally are 6 or 7 hours later. But there was about an eightfold difference between people, normal people, in how they responded. And so you suddenly realise when you look at these graphs, there's no such thing really as average. Your chance of being average is actually very slim.
Right.
And so when your doctor says, OK, your levels are above or below average, well, you know, what is that really?
Yeah.
It becomes slightly meaningless. And the second thing we showed is that there was very little genetic component. So I know there are lots of people out there saying genes are important, and I used to be one of them.
We've had people sitting here talking about it. Yeah.
And genes certainly have an important role in many diseases, and I'm not dismissing them. And identical twins are nearly most similar for all these diseases in some way. But unlike some traits, your response to foods was hardly genetic at all. So less than 30% sugar changes was genetic, and less than 10% for fat and insulin.
That's extraordinary. So that means that really, if you look at your ancestry and, you know, perhaps you see a whole tranche of, you know, very heavily set people, and you're thinking, is that going to be me? Am I predetermined to look like that and to have those kind of characteristics physically? You're saying from your research that that's not necessarily the case, that you have the power, or the microbes have the power, to transform.
Yes. I mean, what it's showing is that genes aren't that important. Therefore, by definition, the environment is important. Mm-hmm. And you can modify to a large extent your environment. And a lot of that is due to diet and other things you can do generally. But diet is predominantly the major factor there. But we also found other factors that influenced these differences, such as time of day you ate.
You have
the identical meal time. If you had it at breakfast or at lunch, you can get a different response. And most people ended up, if they had the identical meal, their sugars were higher at lunchtime than they were for breakfast.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a bad thing.
Right.
So in general, what we want to do is to lessen the peaks.
Right.
So you want to have your sugar cleared out of your system quickly, the fats cleared out of your system quickly. So you want to have a nice profile that little tiny little blips, but they go down quickly. Those people are clearing away the sugars and the fats, and it's not being stored in their bodies, not being stored in their fat cells.
Right.
It's just being burnt off as energy. That's what we want to see. And we know that people who have these high peaks in both are more likely to put on weight long term, have diabetes and heart disease.
Does this mean that you then, is it on average, I know we're talking about averages here, that you could have sugars for breakfast, or you better to have them at lunch, or obviously not at all?
What it means is if you, for some people, it's not
for
the majority of people, and it tend to be more for young people, if you had to have a food, you would pick to have it at breakfast rather than later in the day.
Right.
If it was a sugary carb food.
So you'd be better off earlier on.
But. When I've tested myself, I'm the opposite.
Are you?
So if I have the same food and I was eating these standard muffins, my response got less as the day went on.
Right. So you could have one for tea, but you shouldn't have it for breakfast.
And so for me, it could be that I'm metabolically better. I'm someone who perhaps should skip breakfast.
Right.
And just have two meals a day, as many people should.
Well, that's what I'm doing, and that's what I'm hearing about for this kind of form of intermittent fasting, where you have a kind of 12 to 15 hour gap between last mouthful at night and then first mouthful the next day. Is that something that is, you think, a general rule, or again, is it very specific to individuals? Because I'm encouraging people actually to skip breakfast and have that fasting period, that block of time.
I think it's always, since doing this study, I'm very dangerous. I mean, wary about giving general advice to everybody.
Sure.
But I think given that the current guidelines say never skip breakfast and carry on grazing and have your five or six meal periods a day, I think definitely that is not good advice for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd advise everybody to experiment with skipping breakfast, and everybody to experiment about going on a restricted time eating and having a 14-hour fast,
yeah.
or doing an occasional intermittent fast once or twice a week of some kind.
Yeah.
Because I think they're all related, and this meal timing business is really important. And how much of it is due to just the extended time? How much is when you're eating at different times? How much is due to your own personal circadian rhythm is not clear.
Mm.
But what is absolutely true is that, you know, these standardized, everyone has should have the same 2,000 calories divided in
at
six
a
meals.
Time. Yes, is not
and
right.
And they should never skip one.
Yeah.
That is proved to be complete nonsense.
Yeah.
And so that's the key message, is that people need to find out what suits them.
Yes.
And it turns out about a third of people do naturally skip breakfast anyway,
mm-hmm.
although they're told off by everybody,
yes.
by their doctors for doing that,
yeah.
Who aren't keeping up with the literature.
Yeah.
So that's really the general rule. And we're hoping in our study, because we have masses of sleep data,
mm.
We have masses of intervals or these foods in our studies, and we're going to be doing more of these studies, that we will be able to unravel this. And we hope to be able to, as well as being able to predict with our studies, because the point of collecting all this masses of data, you know, we're talking, our study, just to give you a scale, we had to bake 32,000 muffins, most of them coloured bright blue.
And white
you
ask blue?
Why. You can see bright blue when it hits the toilet.
Oh, no.
Afterwards.
So you can see the transit time.
We get them to time when it it goes into the toilet. Yes, that was often a bit of a shock, because people had often forgotten in that. But because your transit time is really important for your gut health and, mm-hmm. and for all these other
What should our transit time be? What's a healthy length of time?
Again, what's average? You know, it's 24 hours is...
Okay. Yeah.
Is good. If it goes to sort of 2 to 3 days, that's not
okay.
good.
Okay, okay.
But there's a wide variation of normal.
Should we be going every day?
Yes.
We should.
We should be going every day.
Okay.
I think every day or twice a day is what people should be aiming for.
And when we touched there on the kind of intermittent fasting, or the gaps between meal times, is that so our microbes can have a rest? Do they need to have a bit of recovery time when they're not processing food?
Everything points to that direction. So most of these studies are in mice, though, because it's quite hard to do these studies.
Mm.
You can't, unfortunately, you know, take all these samples as much from humans as you can from mice.
Mm.
But it looks like, our microbes change overnight.
Do they?
So even overnight, when you're just having a 12-hour fast between 8 and 8 or something, different team of microbes come out. And these guys live off the lining of your gut, not food. And they end up tidying up your gut lining and keeping it nice and pure, functioning well, so the gut wall is working
That's
really
amazing.
Well. And they seem to have a really positive effect on the body. So it's like a cleaning team coming in.
Do you need to have that
in your
window?
Office and
so, yes, I mean, I'm going to be thinking about that now as I kind of stretch out the time between meals to think, right, guys, I've got my little task force inside me cleaning up the gut.
And these guys, and you know, when you look at the type, there's one called Akkermansia, and it is also associated with people have most of these microbes tend to be thinner than those that don't. So they seem to have a positive effect on the rest of the community. And so that's why one rationale in the microbial world for having fasting periods or not eating all the time is to give these guys, you know, a change. And it just changes the scenery, and it's a bit tidying up, gets rid of the mess maybe, and allows the whole community to really flourish in a sort of normal cycle.
What else can we do to encourage our Akkermansia then? Because they sound like the good guys.
We don't know, and there are people working on it. There's companies trying to put it into probiotics.
I was going to say, can you take it? Can you take a pill full of Akkermansia?
They're starting to be on the market. They're not easy to grow.
Right.
A lot of these particularly effective bugs, they only like living in your bowels.
Right.
They don't like living on the chemist shop and, you know, for days in some dry.
But can we feed them? Can we nurture? How do we create an environment where we're going to get these good bugs flourishing, other than rest and sleep?
We don't know for sure, but we think it's, you know, a high fiber plant diet with, you know, good rest intervals.
Right. So is that things like inulin? So the resistant starches.
Yes, I mean, it's a variety of these. There's some data that berries, etc. Lots of ways in general to feed your microbes. Mm-hmm. So general fiber and inulin is one of the ones we know most about. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. the others don't work.
Yeah.
Just we know most about that. And that's in the sort of family of leeks and onions and garlic and artichokes.
Right.
But you've also got this whole other area which people don't know much about, or haven't heard much about, that are called polyphenols.
Mm.
And the ones in berries, particularly these polyphenol chemicals, are like nutrients for things like your achromantia. So you need to sort of link this variety of diverse berries, for example.
Yeah.
Anything brightly coloured generally has lots of these plant protective chemicals,
particularly purple,
polyphenols.
I've heard. Sorry? Sort of particularly purple, you know, black cherries and blueberries and blackberries, that kind of thing.
They have the ones that stain your hands.
Yes.
Generally have these anthocyanins
that
are particularly good for your microbes. But I think it's the diversity that counts. There's no point just having, 2 litre smoothies of a single berry every day. We don't know which is the best one. And so I think the key is variety and seasonal, and just giving, you know, different variants of the same things. Mm. And as well as berries, you've also got nuts and seeds as mm-hmm. sources of polyphenols. You've got coffee.
Yeah, that's good news, isn't it?
Yeah.
Chocolate.
And dark chocolate, more than about 70%.
Fabulous.
Which rules out most English chocolates.
But you can still get the good dark stuff.
And the purer it is, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's worth paying a bit more for a stronger, better, higher quality chocolate. And then you've got olive oil. And
I was going to ask you about that because I'm seeing
high quality
more and more.
Ones, not the low quality ones.
Extra virgin
has to be
olive oil.
Has to be extra virgin.
EVOO, EVO. You see that
and
more and more talked about.
You have to look at the label closely because in this country they fool you with all kinds of trickery.
Tell me about it.
Italian peasants collecting stuff. And, of course, this is refined rubbish from anywhere.
Yeah.
So
what is it about olive oil in particular, then, that's so beneficial?
It has one of the highest ratings of polyphenols. So the olive skins, basically, when they're high quality, have huge numbers of protective chemicals. And we think it's that property that gives it this heart benefit, etc.
Isn't that amazing? So it is uniquely to the olive. It's not because it's a monounsaturated fat. It's because it comes from olives.
That's the new thinking. I mean, that's why. But until we knew about the microbes, we didn't realise why these polyphenols were important.
Yeah.
We just call them antioxidants, which is just another way of saying we haven't got a clue what it means. if you're a doctor or a scientist, you just bander these words around. But now we know that polyphenols are actually rocket fuel for your microbes, then it all starts to make sense that you want to get these really high quality products that it comes from some plant or the seed of the skin of a plant or anything else. And you get the same things from a lot of high quality plants. So it's not like there's only one or there's only one type of grape. Red wine's another good example.
And this is great news, isn't it, really?
Because it's the
stuff
skin.
Here.
Because all this good stuff is generally in the skin or the peel, the outside, that is exposed to the element.
Yeah.
That's the bit that you want most of. So
now I want to talk to you about that, because if we're talking about the skin and the outside, how important is it then to make sure that it's not coated in pesticides? Because presumably a pesticide would also be a microbicide. And would it be affecting your gut bacteria?
That's a good and tricky question.
Sorry.
And so there's a bit of trade-off at the moment about if you take a fruit or a vegetable and it's not organic, therefore it has high levels of pesticides or herbicides. A lot of people are particularly concerned about glyphosate in Roundup, which is the world's most common herbicide.
Yeah.
And we're all exposed to it every single day, even if we only eat organic.
Sure.
We're still getting traces of it. And you wash it off, but it does penetrate below the skin. You can try and peel everything and peel your grapes and do this.
But then you're peeling away the polyphenols.
Then you're peeling away your polyphenols. So, and it doesn't always get rid of the herbicide and pesticide. So, and also you're getting rid of a lot of fiber.
Yeah.
If you do that. So I think we should be eating the skin of our fruits and vegetables, and we should be aiming to have lower levels of these herbicides and pesticides. And if you can afford it, you should be you know, buying organic, because there isn't hard evidence yet, but there's some suggestive evidence that these herbicides are safe for humans, but they attack our gut microbes. And so if you were going to take your chances, you'd say, well, there probably are, if you're ingesting a lot, as many people do, or if, you know, you're mainly vegetarian like myself, actually you end up eating more of this stuff than someone who just eats a lot of meat. So it's becoming an increasing concern, and there have been these unproven cases of these rare blood cancers that have been related to glyphosate. I don't think it's a huge problem. I think it's a very low-level problem, so I don't think anyone should go get too worried about it overnight. But I think it's just one of these areas that no one's bothered researching.
No
one has said, we've been using this stuff since the 1970s. It's in virtually every food. It's in huge levels in things like oat porridge and the breakfast.
The things that we're told is really healthy to eat.
In certain healthy foods. And if you have it over periods of years, it may have a detrimental effect on your gut microbes. So there's a little bit of study in mice, but no good studies yet in humans.
So are we saying then that glyphosate is disrupting the microbiome in some way?
Definitely. What we don't know is quite how much.
That's and really over a what scary period of time. Thing.
So, but this general rule about food safety runs, that's just a good, one example of many areas where, because this is a new field, it's like a new organ, no one tests any food against these gut microbes.
Maybe that will happen in the future, do you think? That as part of food standards, food safety, let's see what the impact is on gut health.
I think the food companies are very
keen to avoid that.
And they're using all their lobbying power to dissuade governments from going down that route, because that will mean extra costs for them, and these all these ultra cheap, ultra processed products will have that as a problem. But it should, we should be having this break, because with things like the sugar tax, meaning sugary beverages going down, artificial sweeteners are getting
where do
worse.
You stand? Because I don't use aspartame, for example. I mean, I might have it in the house, and I have read some early studies on aspartame as a microbiome disruptor.
I don't think there's any difference between them. So if you're against aspartame, you have sucralose, you might be
really
just as bad, or saccharin. And
why is that? Don't they work in different ways, or do the microbes not differentiate?
They all work in different ways, but we don't understand how they work and how they interact. There are studies showing they all interact in some way with our gut microbes. And the real reason about all these, because aspartame and sucralose are used 50-50 around the world. Okay, so some countries are all one and all the other. But all the studies show the same, that if you do a randomized trial and you take people who are having two cans of fizzy drinks a day and you give them diet fizzy drinks instead, and you follow them for a year, there's no difference in their weight.
Right.
And you say,
what, between having sucralose and aspartame, or full fat sugar?
No, the sugar, you know, the sugar variety, the sugar versus variety, the diet variety. So they can't.
So what is the point?
Well, the point is they shouldn't be called diet.
Diet anything.
Anything. That's just complete, you know,
that's
falsehood.
Yep.
And it also says, well, you know, they're having, you know, 400 calories less a day. Why has that got no effect on their weight over periods of years? And the reason is it's doing something else metabolically to the body. And microbes, we think, are recognizing as some chemical, and that's they're producing other chemicals to try and combat them or deal with them. And that's causing disruption to our bodies and increasing risk of having diabetes and putting on weight despite the lack of calories. So it's another idea that we've been obsessed with calories. And this is a really good example of it's not just about the calories, and that instead of being obsessed with cancer, which is what all this stuff, and there's never been any good evidence that these sweeteners cause cancer, but that's what the public's worry was. No one has thought about, well, actually, you know, what about our gut health and why don't they actually work in helping us reduce weight? So to my mind, they're the they're really exciting areas of the future. And I've done my studies when I was in a metabolic chamber, and I took a few sachets of sucralose which is the other one. And I get a blip on my blood sugar reading.
Do you really? Even with that?
And it's supposed to be inert.
Yes.
So something in my body is recognising it. And whether it's microbes in my saliva, whether it's those in my gut, or it's something triggering in my brain, I don't know. But
it's clearly having an effect.
I'm very worried about the trend of increasing these sweeteners in all kinds of foods and mixed with real sugar, so you can't always tell, mixed with all kinds of packaged foods.
Mm.
And I do think we should really stop and actually do some proper research before we promote it, particularly to kids.
Sure.
Just to get them hooked on sweet things.
So the message is really any kind of sugar or sugary or sweet, we should just be weaning ourselves off, or at least cutting down, whether it's sugar or whether it's a substitute.
Absolutely, yes. There's absolutely no reason why we should be hyping up all these, our sensitivity to sugar.
Yeah.
It's only the food companies are going to benefit
from
this, and not our wastes. But this is something we're going to be studying in our as we expand our series of these diet studies.
When are we going to get this app? I mean, is this being created now? Because it sounds so fascinating to be able to get this personal insight, because clearly that's the way ahead, isn't it? Personalised nutrition, personalised gut health.
I think it is. You know, it doesn't mean we throw out all dietary recommendations, and I think everyone, you know, needs to have more fibre and more plants and less processed food. But, you know, whether fats are for you or carbs are for you, whether you can cope with sucralose or aspartame, whether, you know, like me, you know, I'm much better off having an apple than a pear or a banana.
Really,
of identical,
that specific?
Of identical sugar, you know, of identical sugar
Incredible.
Level.
Yeah.
Or I, you know, difference, but I can have a bowl of pasta that's actually much better for me than having a small sandwich with bread in it, just because I react to the bread.
Mm-hmm.
All these things we're going to be able to predict pretty soon. We've got a predictive model based on the first 1,000 people that allows a 73% accuracy in terms of giving you a new food to eat based on these test meals we've given you and say how you're going to react. And that's in the world of, you know, this world is pretty good. The next phase of the study is doing another couple of thousand people in the US, just shipping stuff to them at home. That's going to go to a sort of beta testing commercial kit with this company Zoe, and we hope that there'll be something, whether it's a beta version or an early commercial version, around in the early part of next year.
Great.
And this will be, we think, in the form of an app on your phone.
So 2020 is kind of a key milestone,
I think,
perhaps, to look out for.
I mean, we're going to be driven by the science.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of these companies that claim there's a black box solution and that, you know, you just have to trust us and everything be fine. It's evolving. So, you know, we're not making huge claims about what we're going to be able to do, but so far it's, you know, all our studies are going much better than we anticipate. And people love being in these studies and volunteering because they can find out so much about themselves.
And when you find it works, that's the thing. When you just hit on the thing that makes you look better, feel better,
yes, and
better.
We even had one of the volunteers in our study actually was Yota Motolenghi.
Oh, really?
And he was interested in not only the blue muffins, but
sure.
We're waiting to see if he's got the best microbes in the business, because he should have the most diverse vegetables. if anyone's tried to do his, follow his menus with the pomegranate seeds. And
absolutely.
He should be good. So, keep an eye on the website, which is joinzoe.com.
Great. Excellent.
To sign up if you want to be part of any of these studies, or, you know, to see how close we're getting to the app.
Well, I certainly will. So let's finish on going from the high-tech future, take a back step with some of the ancient things that we know can help, the fermented foods, the kefirs, the kombuchas. Are you a fan of these things?
Absolutely. I didn't know anything about them 5 years ago.
Really?
Now I'm an expert, and I actually make my own of everything. So not only that, you know, I make my own sourdough. I went on a kimchi course and
Amazing.
I make my own kimchi. I do my own kefir and kombucha. And, you know, just doing it also, I think it's something every kid should learn to do one of these things.
Fantastic. What a great
idea. Teaches you about microbes.
Yeah.
You can watch it grow. It's like a little pet.
Yes.
You've got in the kitchen.
Yeah, forget the Tamagotchi.
And you realise that each one is slightly different. And that's because the chemicals they're producing are slightly different in the environment. And you think that's what's going on inside our guts. I think it's a great lesson to teach kids. And, of course, that's really key to the future of health is trying to get this education out there. So having some form of fermented food every day, however small.
Really, can just be a spoonful. Important.
Just be a spoonful. You know, I have a, if I'm late, I have a, you know, a shot of kefir as I'm rushing out the house.
Yeah, sure.
I just make sure that I'm having something. And, of course, getting high-quality cheese.
Yeah.
Everyone can sneak that in at the end of a meal.
Yep.
You know, the good stuff, ideally unpasteurized raw milk is good. But all of these things, you know, and find one that works for you. You know, people have lots of different tastes and the idea is to experiment. Mm. So fermented food's great. Diversity of plants is really crucial as well. Yeah. So there's many different ones. We think the magic number is 30.
Okay, 30 different varieties.
Not a day,
a week.
No,
I was going to say
no, 30 a week. 30
okay,
a week
30 gives, different ones.
Gives the optimal gut diversity. And that, but that can be seeds and nuts and, you know.
Great, but fun. I mean, you could, as a family, you could make a chart, stick it on the fridge.
Yes.
Check off your 30, write your checklist every time
exactly.
you have something new.
And, you know, a bag of mixed nuts is a nice way of cheating and getting, you know, plenty
getting
of good stuff.
Just to start.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I'm always finding nice ways of getting extra diversity into my diet and try new things on a menu. You know, go out there and, when you see something, don't stick to your old favourites. Don't just go for the old, you know, my prawn cocktail on the menu. Just say, I haven't got a clue what that is. Let's try it. And I think that's something I've really embraced since this. And it's fantastic fun and really expanded my taste buds and hopefully my gut microbes.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I will very much hope that you'll come back because you are so fascinating to talk to. And the more I talk to you, the more I want to carry on talking to you. So thank you. And
it'd be my pleasure.
Thank you. That is, alas, all we have time for today. But as always, you will find the details of the resources, the links, everything that Professor Tim has been talking about in today's show over on lizellewellbeing.com. You can sign up to the free newsletter for lots of gut-friendly recipes and plenty more wellbeing wisdom. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. That will mean that you get the next episode downloaded safely without you even having to make a note of it. So until the next time, go well, and thanks to our friends at Bimuno, who are offering listeners of this podcast 10% discount. Visit bimuno.com/balance and use code Liz10 at checkout. Bimuno can also be found online at bimuno.com, Amazon or Ocado, and in Boots and Holland & Barrett stores. Bye-bye. Thank you.